Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You need some help here. We need a new title for the feudal lords on the Chicago City Council. Well, maybe that's it right there. The lords and ladies, Lady Tom Tunney of Ansather, for example. The dukes and duchesses, the royalty, the political ruling class. There's a resolution urging the changing of the title from alderman to just alder. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line.
Handing out your own phone number there, Dan, are you?
I've been deputized by the city council to solicit community input before they make a decision on what the new title would be. So we'll just take your calls on a rolling basis all morning, see if we can narrow things down to something. We'll build consensus to replace the title alderman with something more appropriate.
But they're considering just alder, you said?
This is a resolution.
Or alder person.
Alder.
Okay.
The resolution so advanced weird. By alderman for now, maybe alder, Andre Vasquez. He's a former battle rapper. Okay.
Wait, we got to get some of his work. Andrea Vasquez. What was his street name? Do we know?
Alder. former battle rapper known for his homophobic and misogynistic lyrics, according to Franz Spielman. And I guess according to him, because he said this is a part of changing his ways. It is absolutely a part of making amends because of my prior ignorance and trying to create the kind of city where future generations have a much better understanding than I did growing up. I grew up in a society where nobody talked about these things, so all that was reinstilled was man this and man that, and how men are superior. If this kind of terminology and this kind of language and context were more readily available in the public when I was growing up, I wouldn't be the person who did all that in the past. Maybe be a person who could speak English. Alder, that's perhaps the key to stemming the street violence, do you think, maybe?
Why are they wasting their time on that when they should be wasting their time? We had another carjacking. This time a 16-year-old girl put a gun to a woman's head and got her car. They arrested her, but I'm sure she's going to be out on bond with a electronic monitor bracelet soon.
If future generations have a better understanding, it does make inroads into how people view other genders, plural, and the typical role of what's been presented as men and women. This guy's a real wordsmith, this Andre Vasquez. But alder, not aldermen. Or perhaps something else. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line. And Leslie Harrison, she's a alder.
Woman. I always called aldermen alderwomen. Spokesperson or spokesman, spokesperson. I never said spokeswoman. But I always treated alderwomen as alderwomen.
Yeah. I always treated aldermen as aldermen, because that's the title. Leslie Harrison. It's become very confusing. People are like, I don't know what to call you anymore. Oh, I've got some ideas. My response is generally, the title is alderman. That is what is legally recognized by state statute. If it's going to be changed, it needs to be changed at the state level. Hairston agreeing with Vasquez that state law should be changed then. And making this key point. Now, please, Stop what you're doing and pay attention. This is important. Alderman Leslie Hairston from the 5th Ward. Everybody is not a man. Some people are women. I am not a man. I'm a woman. These are the kind of deep thinkers you have on the city council. If it wasn't bad enough, she ripped that off of an exchange between Earl and Randy on My Name is Earl from about a decade ago.
That's another lie.
But it's a good lie to protect her.
Maybe you should listen to Catalina. She's a woman just like Natalie. They're both women, her and Natalie. You and I are men. We're not women.
Sometimes Randy takes a long road to a simple thought.
You see, men think different than women. You and I think different than Natalie and Catalina because we're men and they're women. I'm right, right? I'm not wrong. Am I wrong?
No.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It was a great lesson there. That used to be satire when it was a sitcom on NBC from 10 years ago. Now it's
a reality.
Now it's the dialogue on this Chicago City Council. Oh. By the way, you know, people sometimes suggest that I really am tough on Chicago.
Too tough, you mean?
Yeah, tough. Yeah, that I'm so down on Chicago. You think I'm down on my hometown. Let me introduce you to Charlottesville Mayor Nikia Walker. Charlottesville, you know, the city that launched Joe Biden's presidential campaign to hear him lie about it. Charlottesville, the beautiful, I'm quoting her, the mayor of Charlottesville. Charlottesville, the beautiful, ugly it is. It rapes you, comforts you in its blank, stained sheet, and tells you to keep its secrets. It covers you with its good intentions. White people say that it is a place where gentrification started with the election of a black woman in 2017. And because of white power, a lie becomes hashtag facts. Its daily practice is that of separating you from your soul. Charlottesville is devoid of a moral compass. Charlottesville rapes you of your breaths. It suffocates you of your hopes and dreams. Charlottesville is anchored in white supremacy and rooted in racism. Charlottesville rapes you and covers you in sullied sheets. It's really driving home the rape metaphor. It's quite a Chamber of Commerce pitch that she's offering.
Yeah,
here.
I can't wait to go visit.
Yeah.
Where do I sign up?
Yeah.
Well, helping tourism there with that statement.
What are the threads?
Ashley Judd, the spokesperson there for the town?
What's the thread count on those sheets?
Is it Giza cotton or just Egyptian cotton? Mm. We want to know.
This is she clearly is part of the Biden unity team, right? Jim in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I have a thought. Call an alderman an alderman, an alderwoman. Or if that's not good enough, let's call them cluster friends, but abbreviate that to cluster F.
Cluster friends. All right. Cluster F. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, you know, Lord and, I don't know, you can't use lady, so maybe just lords. I mean, they are feudal lords. This is a mercantilist system here with lords and serfs. We've been able to keep that form of societal organization going for a lot longer than most. Maybe that's too on the nose. I don't know. Tom in Deer Park.
I'd like to just keep it simple. Member City Council, the abbreviation or acronym would be MCC, which is the same abbreviation or acronym of the Metropolitan Correction Center, the federal jail in the South Loop, which is where they all belong if they're not there already. So MCC, I'd go with.
All right. That's not bad. Thanks for the call, Tom.
What do you think? Because you're
sarcastically
smart.
I always like Lord and Lady, very Game of Thrones, very medieval, which the city is. Duke and Duchess. I mean, the difference is, you know, we have royalty here.
Yeah,
we focus so much on the royalty across the pond, but they don't do anything. They don't have any real power. Here, they actually have functional day-to-day power. I don't know why we're so obsessed with the royalty there. We should be more obsessed with the pronouncements from Lady or Lord Leslie Hairston in the 5th Ward about how men and women are different. Those are the sort of insights you get here.
On an ancillary issue, because you mentioned the Duke and Duchess, I know that you didn't watch the Oprah interview, but during that interview, they said that they had a secret ceremony, you know, in the garden 3 days before their wedding. They came out and admitted that that was a lie. They lied. Didn't happen. Just.
Yeah.
I want to let you down easy.
Yeah, thanks for the update on that.
Okay, I'm just, it never happened. So I don't know why they lied about it, but then again.
Wow.
They're lying about that. What else are they lying
about? Oh, yeah.
I mean,
it's
my
huge.
Gosh.
I mean, it's almost like.
You could be lying about somebody saying that the baby, you know, what color is the skin going to be?
Yeah. It's almost like these two dolts are people of less than redeemable character. What a stunning development that is.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
I'm unbreakable. You can't make me or break me. And I don't give a fuck. None of you niggas can take me. So when I
eat, oh, yeah. He's trying to piss like an Eminem wannabe.
That's Alderman Andre Vasquez. I'm
unbreakable. He's unbreakable.
I'm Alder. Alder.
Oh, yeah, Dan. So you already did it wrong.
Andre Vasquez. Mike in Union, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Jim Henson was way ahead of his time with identities. You know, I remember watching the Muppet Show when I was younger, you know, and you could almost assign each older person a certain puppet or whatever and, you know, go at it like that. I mean, since you have puppets that don't know, you know, what sex they are or, you know, the rapper maybe could be, like, you know, like the animal or whatever and, you know, gender neutral and, you know, confused puppets because that's what they are anyway, so.
Thanks for the call, Mike. How about Call, you know, from Game of Thrones? Just thinking of Game of Thrones. Because that was Call, if you remember, if you're a Game of Thrones fan, was the term for a Dothraki warlord.
Why not just call them warlords?
Well, you could do that, too.
Warlord 47, Warlord 40. Instead of 40th War, just call them warlords and then put their number behind it.
Yeah. I think Call has more flair.
Oh,
yeah,
yes. He's such an intellectual mind.
Yeah. All right.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories. Only the biggest guests. And only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy and Rachel Levine. Dr. Rachel Levine has been confirmed that a transgender individual will be the number two person at Department of Health and Human Services now.
And the first to be confirmed by the Senate, the first openly transgender person. Checking all the boxes still.
Yeah, I openly transgender. Yeah.
You don't think she's hiding it?
Right. Let's try to identify the ones that are hiding being transgender. I mean, I have some guesses. Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, two Republicans who voted for. Remember, this was Dr. Levine's testimony during her confirmation hearing, this important exchange she had with Rand Paul, where Rand Paul pressed Dr. Paul pressed Dr. Levine on her support for transgender surgeries on minors.
Most genital mutilation is not typically performed by force, but as WHO notes, that by social convention, social norm, the social pressure to conform, to do what others do and have been doing, as well as the need to be accepted socially and the fear of being rejected by the community, American culture is now normalizing the idea that minors can be given hormones to prevent their biological development of their secondary sexual characteristics. Dr. Levine, you have supported both allowing minors to be given hormone blockers to prevent them from going through puberty, as well as surgical destruction of a minor's genitalia. Like surgical mutilation, hormonal interruption of puberty can permanently alter and prevent secondary sexual characteristics. The American College of Pediatricians reports that 80 to 95% of prepubertal children with gender dysphoria will experience resolution by late adolescence if not exposed to medical intervention and social affirmation. Dr. Levine, do you believe that minors are capable of making such a life-changing decision as changing one's sex?
Well, Senator, thank you for your interest in this question. Transgender medicine is a very complex and nuanced field with robust research and standards of care that have been developed. And if I am fortunate enough to be confirmed as the Assistant Secretary of Health, I will look forward to working with you and your office and coming to your office and discussing the particulars of the standards of care for transgender medicine.
The specific question.
So danced around the question. He asked another way, too. I remember watching this thinking, oh, my God, that's what's next. We're going to let our kids decide when they're not even adults because they're children, whether or not they want to cut off their naughty bits and get a double mastectomy.
The question was about minors. Let's be a little more specific since you evaded the question. Do you support the government intervening to override the parent's consent to give a child puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and or amputation surgery of breasts and genitalia? You have said that you're willing to accelerate the protocols for street kids. I'm alarmed that poor kids with no parents who are homeless and distraught, you would just go through this and allow that to happen to a minor. I would hope that you would have compassion for Kira Bell, who's a 23-year-old girl who was confused with her identity. At 14, she read on the internet about something about transsexuals. She thought, well, maybe that's what I am. She ended up getting these puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones. She had her breasts amputated. But here's what ultimately she says now. And this is a very insightful decision from someone who made a mistake but was led to believe this was a good thing by the medical community. I made a brash decision as a teenager, as a lot of teenagers do, trying to find confidence and happiness, except now the rest of my life will be negatively affected, she said, adding that the medicalized gender transitioning was a very temporary, superficial fix for a very complex identity issue. What I'm alarmed at is that you're not willing to say absolutely minors shouldn't be making decisions to amputate their breast or to amputate their genitalia. For most of our history, we believe that minors don't have full rights and the parents need to be involved. So I'm alarmed that you won't say with certainty that minors should not have the ability to make the decision to take hormones that will affect them for the rest of their life. Will you make a more firm decision on whether or not minors should be involved in these decisions?
Senator, transgender medicine is a very complex and nuanced field, and if confirmed to the position of Assistant Secretary of Health, I would certainly be pleased to come to your office and talk with you and your staff about the standards of care.
Uh-huh. You know, that's sort of...
It's your Democratic Party.
That's sort of open flouting of non-answer, of refusing to answer a question is really something. This is the number two official at Health and Human Services. And I'm just going to dismiss your questions by giving you this rinse and repeat, essentially taking the fifth. During a confirmation hearing, should have been disqualifying.
Yeah, so, and Senator Paul even said, well, at the end, because he tried and tried, he said, well, I guess you're not going to answer my question.
Yeah, that's not sufficient. It would have been better to say, you're vile. Here's what we know, Dr. Levine. We know you support castrating minors. That's what we know. And you won't admit it. You won't take a position on the issue. You very well have studied the issue. You've previously indicated what your position is. You won't say it in public. Why, coward? Why won't you? Because you know it is an offensive position. You know it is an indefensible position.
That's barbaric.
And to allow Dr. Levine to get away with that in a confirmation hearing without putting it right between Dr. Levine's eyes was a mistake. Even as good as Rand Paul's interrogation was.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I don't like Dr. Levine also because, again, folks, in May, he removed his 95-year-old mother out of a care facility because that nursing home was directed to take COVID patients. He checked her into a hotel for a few months with a caregiver and then put her back in when things calmed down because he knew. So other people's moms and dads could die, but not his mom or her mom. Excuse me.
You might as well have Charlize Theron as number two at HHS, right? The position of my child is whatever he or she says she is whenever he or she says he or she is.
She doesn't have a son or a daughter. They're going to decide if they're a son or a daughter.
Yeah, which is the position of a lot of people. And you know how that gets advanced in addition to the conversation about trans and trans individuals in sports. You know how that gets advanced? When you give people like Dr. Rachel Levine a pass. When you normalize barbaric positions.
And you know he, she wouldn't have been chosen if they were not transgender.
And it's not just the left that falls prey to that, of course. Once there is this cultural zeitgeist afoot, you have even celebrated conservatives up until this point, like South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. Kristi Noem declining to sign legislation that was sent to her desk to codify that men and women have to play, boys and girls, men and women have to play sports associated with their biological sex in South Dakota. That included at the collegiate level. And that's where Kristi Noem had a problem because she didn't want to lose NCAA events for her state. Also, some suggestion made, she didn't want to lose an Amazon distribution center scheduled to be constructed in her state.
But that's why you had to take a stance.
She went on with Tucker Carlson the other night, tried to explain this. See if this is persuasive to you.
Okay.
But wait. So you're saying the NCAA threatened you and you don't think you can win that fight. They said, if you sign this, we won't allow girls in South Dakota to play. And you don't think you can win in court, even though the public overwhelmingly supports you nationally. And so you're caving to the NCAA. I think that's what you're saying.
No, that's not right at all, Tucker. In fact, you're wrong completely. Okay. I've been working on this issue for years. In fact, several years ago, I fought USDA to make sure that 4-H rodeo and that the sport of rodeo could keep girls events, and boys events. So I've been working on this for many, many years. And back since November, I've been consulting with legal scholars and professors across the country, asking them, how do I protect women's sports? And they've gone through the steps to how I would legally challenge the NCAA and keep them from bullying the state of South Dakota. And what they've told me to do is that I need to build a coalition. So that's why today I launched DefendTitleIX.com. And that's going to allow us to build a coalition of states that can fight the NCAA. Listen, I'm sick and tired of the NCAA threatening states, challenging us, and bullying us. And so we're going to build a coalition of leaders, athletes, and people who want to protect women's sports and want to make sure that our women keep Title IX in place to protect their right to be competitive and to be rewarded by participating in these team sports, and make sure this coalition can fight the NCAA to make sure we're protecting Title IX.
Persuaded? First of all, the NCAA bullying us as a state, bullying a governor, bullying a state. Bullying is a weasel word. I'm sorry, it's been stripped of any meaning through overuse. Weasel word. You're not being bullied. You're succumbing to pressure. You're not the victim. You're not passive in this. You're active. You're the governor. You're making a choice.
Yeah, she's choosing to have them govern her state rather than herself, that letting them get what they want.
Albert Mohler makes the point succinctly here in his daily briefing, I should say, what's going on here. What we see here is the form of coercion that is brought in the larger culture against anyone who would defy the LGBTQ revolution. What we're looking at is how change in society actually happens. It often happens by legislation or court action, but where the action really happens, the most effective action, is often in the form of social and emotional and financial coercion. And the question is, will you stand up or will you be extorted out of a position you say you hold? Coerced out of it, incentivized out of it. Alliance for Defending Freedom responded to Noem's, legal scholars tell me I couldn't win, or the NCAA would win if they took this legislation to court. It's poppycock. And first of all, even if you thought that was true, even if that was more likely than not, you don't do what you think is right based on what you think court challenges, how you think court challenges will play out? Talk about incentivizing the trial bar to litigate everything. Incentivizing your political opponents to litigate everything. If we litigate it and there's a chance Kristi Noem might lose, then she just folds and goes along with our side. Weasel position, to complement the weasel words. Alliance for Defending Freedom. The truth is, Governor Noem has taken the teeth out of this bill by exempting colleges, or wanting to. And her hands are not tied by any NCAA policy like she's claimed. She has the ability and the opportunity to be a serious champion for girls and women, and we hope she does so by signing the legislation, which demonstrates real courage and seriousness in addressing the challenges facing a rising generation of young women. If Governor Noem is concerned about litigation, ADF, Alliance for Defending Freedom, would stand with her to defend the legislation if she signs it. Mm-hmm. Daniel in Evanston.
Hello?
Yeah. Hello. Daniel, go ahead.
I like you, Dan, but this Noem situation, this illustrates what's wrong with this, your sort of pro-corporate Koch brothers ideology. These corporations are a problem. Why do you think big tech censors conservatives? Because they're not scared of Republicans, because Republicans don't use power. They don't use regulations to damage big tech, to force them to change. But they respect Democrats because they will use power.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Daniel. I'm not a pro Koch brothers corporate type, but and you're wrong about the free market, generally speaking. There's every opportunity right here to fight the corporate influence. Why? What's the point of electing conservatives? A Trump supporter like Kristi Noem, if you're not going to stand up when it's time to stand up, what regulation are you going to advance to supplant or replace a lack of courage among people who say they're on your side? You can't replace it. You can't replace it with a law. You can't replace it with an administrative rule. That's the mistake that those mercantilists who support Trump make. You think you can just wave away your enemies with a regulation? No. Listen to what Albert Mohler said. You're losing the culture. You're losing the culture the politicians follow. The most effective action, the form of social, emotional, financial coercion. Not legal. Vincent St. Charles.
Good morning, guys. I don't know why they put these people in front of a committee, except, I guess, for Rand Paul. They always approve them. And parents who even think they're going to have kids, I'm 63, I don't have any kids, so I don't have nothing in the game. They better start getting involved, because nominating people like this are scary for the future and for our kids. Better get involved. That's all. Thank you.
Call Vince. Greg in LaGrange.
Hi, good morning. You know, I'm running out of adjectives to define these people, but I think I found a new one in ghoulish. This, the problem, and I'm just picking up on this stuff at its most inane and its most intense evil level, is the destruction of our families and our parents and our ability to teach our children the right and wrong of culture and Western civilization. I picked this up in a Christopher Rufo article I just read about in North Carolina. Same thing, where they're separating children from their parents and their teachings. It's evil. It's a separation of culture and Western civilization. And I won't go to Albert Mohler, I'll go to Thomas More and say, you know, when you have your principles in your hand and you open your fingers a little bit, those principles escape you and you often never get them back. This is a fight that we have to fight every day for every inch, because our culture and Western civilization is at stake.
Thanks, Greg.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Yesterday was quote-unquote equal pay day. And, of course, identitarians will be identitarians. And So Jill Biden, not a doctor, got together some gals to bitch about something that isn't real. Who would be the obvious choice to make ignorant statements with just the right amount of moral indignation? How about U.S. women's soccer team star Megan Rapinoe?
I saw her yesterday in D.C.
Win 4 World Cup championships and 4 Olympic gold medals for the United States. And despite those wins, I've been devalued, I've been disrespected, and dismissed because I am a woman. And I've been told that I don't deserve any more than less because I am a woman. You see, despite all the wins, I'm still paid less than men who do the same job that I do. For each trophy, of which there are many, and for each win, for each tie, and for each time that we play, it's less. And I know there are millions of people who are marginalized by gender in the world and experience the same thing in their jobs. And I know that there are people who experience even more, where the layers of discrimination continue to stack against them. And I and my teammates are here for them. We on the U.S. Women's National Team today are here because of them.
Is she right? Because I know that's the popular view. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Let's hear from you, ladies. Is she right? Is she your spokes?
Spokes what, Dan?
Spokes, just like it's not alderman anymore. It's alder spokes. Is she your spokes?
I mean, she has an accomplished soccer career. You're not going to take the wins away from her 4 World Cup championships.
Is anybody trying to?
Well, she's acting like they are. She's trying to be a victim, but because she's not as paid as much as men are in soccer. Well, there's a reason for that. Just like the NCAA women's brackets compared to the men's tournament. More people are interested and more advertising dollars are poured into the men's sport because that's what people watch. And personally, as a woman, as an athlete too, I prefer to watch men's NCAA tournament. I prefer to watch men's soccer. I don't mind watching women's soccer. But it's not, you know, this whole equal pay. Does she not understand how advertising dollars work? How the machine wheels spin? Does she not get that? I could walk her through it.
Well, she's a proponent of equity. And equity means equal outcomes, regardless of the underlying realities that you're describing. I mean, I don't understand anybody who wants to watch men or women play soccer. But, yeah, that you put your finger right on it. It turns out, more people are interested in paying to watch men play soccer than they are to pay women play soccer. Sorry, but I know what you're going to do. You're going to change the world for us. You're going to demand that people be just as interested in women's sports as they are in men's sports. Okay, fine. Then just say that. Or why isn't she challenged on that? I've been dismissed and disrespected.
Yeah, by who?
Yeah.
Or
name whom? Names. You know, you're so courageous. You're not going to take any guff from anybody, particularly no man, right, sister? So name names. Provide the stories. It's like Lori Lightfoot's foray into being a victim of sexual harassment. Do tell.
When it turned out to just be harassment, yeah.
If that. I'm still waiting for more detail. Mm-hmm. Do tell. Tell us all about it. And this isn't, obviously, I mean, for Megan Rapinoe, it's just about Megan Rapinoe, clearly. But this is not it. This is a canard that is spread all the time and occasioned on the day, equal pay day. And a lot of people believe that it's true, that women make 72 cents, 77 cents, 71 cents, whatever the moving
number. Well, it's 82 cents. And then if you're black, it's 53 cents. Yeah. And if you're Latino, it's 55 cents.
Right.
That's what was on NBC News last night.
Exactly.
They showed the man and the dollar, and then they showed the woman, the black woman, and the Hispanic woman.
So people believe that, and it's
right.
And it's not true. It's not true. Does that matter? It does matter. Why? Because it's another way to claim victim status, and it's another way to make an appeal based on your identity, not your work history, or your work product, or your chosen profession. Megan Rapinoe. Mike in Melrose Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. If she wants equal pay, why doesn't she do equal work and go play on the men's team and be equal to the guys that are getting more? Because they book more money and they get paid by what they do.
Right, but she can't make the men's team. It's not possible.
I understand that. That's my point. Didn't they get beat by a high school team or something a couple of years ago?
Yeah, 15-year-olds.
How much do those kids get paid?
Yeah, right.
It was 15-year-olds in Dallas, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they should be out there. We don't make as much as Megan Rapinoe.
We make nothing.
Where's our Nike deal? I want to do a commercial with Usain Bolt. We beat her. The larger issue, getting beyond the navel gazing of the U.S. women's soccer team, and they're really an insufferable group, aren't they? I hate to say that about a national team, but they're a bunch of identitarian political hacks lined up right behind Rapinoe. I mean, there's been studies on this. You know, you'll be not shocked to learn. Department of Labor found a difference in earnings of 5 to 7% after controlling factors affecting workers' wages. The study estimated that occupation and industry accounted for about 25% of the difference between men's and women's earnings. Hours worked accounted for about 10%. Biggest factor, the number of children, then time outside the labor force, of course. 2020 report from payscale.com found a 19% uncontrolled pay gap, but only a 2% controlled pay gap, with career disruptions accounting for the largest difference in men's and women's wages. Yeah, it's just not the case. When you control for the decisions people make about children, thus continuity in the workforce, about profession, about hours worked, this all just melts away. But it's a very useful issue for the demagogues to do what they do and to try to use this as a cudgel to lay claim for more stuff unearned. Orlando on the north side.
Hi, Dan and Amy. I just wanted to say I had a power bar with Megan, whatever her name is, Reno, whatever.
Lapinoe.
Now I haven't eaten it in 6 months because I can't stand what she said in the Olympics about America. Now I'm definitely just going to throw it away. I want nothing to do with that girl.
All right, what
so anti-American.
Thanks, Orlando.
I can't remember what she said to you about America.
She doesn't like it. Bill in Cape Coral, Florida, is.
Hi, I identify as a woman. I shave before every game, but I run faster than the other girls. I kick the ball harder than the other girls. I get more money than the other girls, but I'm just better than them. I don't know what it is.
That's a great Vera DeMilo, Jim Carrey impersonation you're doing. Yeah, that's not bad.
Sorry.
I love this. You know, every year, Mark Perry, a University of Michigan economist friend who blogs at Carpe Diem, takes the occasion of Equal Pay Day to call for Equal Occupational Fatality Day to underscore the point that the occupations you choose
are different than men's
and make a difference. It's certainly in pay and also in risk. So, you know, for example, the fatality injury rate per 100,000 workers, you know what the most dangerous profession is by a wide margin?
Coal miners?
No.
Construction?
That's number five. I feel like Richard Dawson. Survey
set.
That's number five.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Keep going.
Pipe fitters?
Deadliest catch.
Deadliest? Really?
Think deadly.
Fishermen.
Commercial
fishermen. Fishermen. Really? Okay.
145 deaths per 100,000 workers. The commercial fishing business is 99.9% male. Logging workers, 68 deaths per 100,000, 98% male. Aircraft pilots, 61 per 100,000, 92.5% male. Roofers, 54 per 100,000, 98% male. Construction trades, 40 per 100,000, 96.5% male. And so on and so forth. So you want to do the 82 cents on the dollar. Okay, well, for women to catch up, Equal Occupational Fatality Day won't be until May 9th of 2031. Yeah. 92% of U.S. occupational fatalities in 2020, men. Almost 4,900 versus 437 for women. So where's the equity? We need to kill off more women on the job, apparently. Radio talk show host not on the list.
Oh, come on. I thought it'd be number three.
But, I mean, this is that's a silly statement I just made. But, I mean, that's the silliness of the equity ideology, isn't it? Scott in Hanover Park.
Yeah, good morning. Didn't she go and play soccer representing the U.S. but couldn't stand for any of the national anthems? I mean, the brain power here is incredible. Lack of it. Let me be a little sarcastic here. But you would think you would learn from what happened to professional sports that in other sports representing this country, if you really want to tick off your audience, that's the way to do it. Then you come back to us looking for validation, or you're upset because we disrespect you, allegedly. I think she kind of set herself up for these sort of things.
Thanks for the call,
Yeah, she
Scott.
Took a knee during the World Cup when they were in Spain, and then against France, too. And she got in a Twitter fight with, you know, President Trump.
Yeah, right.
Back and forth.
One other thing, too, just in terms of the actual research on the topic. I know that's of no interest to those charlatans out there promoting this, from Jill Biden, not a doctor, on down. Harvard did a study looking at workers who performed the exact same job in a unionized environment that had rigid pay scales and prohibited gender-based pay discrimination. Got all that? So their solution, right, was applied or was examined in the study. Their applied solution was research. The researchers found an 11% pay gap between men and women. According to the authors, the weekly earnings gap can be explained by the workplace choices that women and men make, with women choosing to take more unpaid leave and to work fewer overtime hours than men. Why do people tolerate those around them telling falsehoods over and over and over for years uninterrupted? You think it's, that let her believe what she wants or let him believe what he wants. No. No. This is exactly how you go down this road to serfdom that we are well down. I mean, these lies have been perpetrated for decades, virtually unchallenged. I mean, other than by the actual research and people who are willing to raise the conversation and the evidentiary support for the two positions. Remarkable. Teresa on the north side.
Good morning, Amy and Dan. You know, I love football, and I pay a good price to go to Soldier Field and watch the Bears mostly lose, but still. The stands are packed. I mean, could you imagine if Soldier Field opened up for a women's flag football game? I mean, I think the only people who would be there would be friends and family, and the tickets would probably be about $15.
Unless it's a lingerie league.
You know?
That's exactly what I was thinking. We're on
I sat next to a linebacker on the lingerie league once on a flight. Riveting. I'll tell you about it later if you want to go out to lunch.
That.
Wow.
Yeah, but people would, I mean, even those games didn't sell out.
You always get the best seatmates.
I know, I really do.
I sit next to guys that look like Governor Spaulding. Teresa, thanks for the call, and you know, good luck at Soldier Field this year. You have an exciting new quarterback named
Andy
Dalton.
What's his name?
Andy Dalton.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's so bad I had to Google him because I didn't know who he was.
There'll be a lot of defensive touchdowns. Andy Dalton is the cause of Soldier Field this year. The Lingerie Football League.
The Lingerie League. That was awesome.
Why did that
go
away?
What are those things called?
Shoulder pads?
No, well, they had shoulder hip pads, but they had some lacing and a bustier and those things, what you tie to your hose. Oh, my God, I can't think. Is it been
hose?
That long? No, you're like
a garter belt. Are you shaming sex workers?
No.
No,
she would wear a garter belt. That was her thing.
No.
So, God, what was her name? She was so nice.
Whatever happened to the Lingerie Football League?
I'm going to find out right now. We had one in Chicago. Remember they played at the... Out in Hoffman Estates.
Boy, do I. I miss them. I miss the Honey Bears.
Oh, the honey bears. I miss Virginia McCaskey took them away.
I miss when, you know.
When we used to be able to go to football games. I miss that thing called school. I miss
when life was enjoyable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I miss it. Joe in Hoffman Estates.
Hey, you know, Rapinoe's going to be, this kind of segues into your last segment. She's going to be in for a shock when she's out of a job because all the women running around in the soccer field have testicles.
Okay. I mean, does any soccer player actually have testicles?
Okay.
I'm going to hear from John Cass on that.
Yeah, I'm sure. He's texting you right now. Boy, this lingerie football league, what?
Hey,
wow.
Towel off over there.
I mean, oh boy. Oh my.
Mary Kay in Western Springs.
Google that and put images in. Whew.
Ooh, you are so funny this morning, guys. Yeah, yawn is what I say. This has been going on since the early 70s. All you do is listen to pay and equity, yeah. And that's been going
since
on.
Bella Abzug was burning her bra, and nobody wants to see that. Yeah.
Yeah, I got two things. So, you know, I left the workforce by choice. And, you know, like, if you don't have the experience, I miss the whole technology thing. Like a lot of people my age, we don't know anything about, or we're so behind on technology that we're not useful. So there you go. Who wants to hire somebody who can't figure out a computer program? Nobody, you know. So there you go. You miss the experience. A lot of men worked right through all that. They know more, so they make more money. Yeah. They're worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
What's wrong with that?
They do jobs that we're not willing to do.
Yeah.
Not that we don't want to do them.
I say the commercial fishing industry should be completely turned over to women. Men should be barred.
Yeah. Sure.
Let's see how that goes. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. Let's see how that goes when you're trying to order that grouper sandwich at your favorite seafood joint. Cindy and Joliet.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
You know, if you look at this Megan Rapinoe thing really pragmatically, she's starting her campaign to become someone in Washington. I can see her being assigned, you know, ambassador for women of some obscure country to champion the rights of these women. American women are quite capable of championing for themselves because half of what she says, if not a higher percentage, is just straight up fiction. And she's on her own campaign trail to get herself poised so somebody goes, hey, let's look at Rapinoe for that. Of course, she's not going to be able to have rainbow hair colors, but, you know, maybe by the time she's a politician, rainbow hair colors will be in for them. I don't know.
Thanks.
She's a pain in the patootie, and I think she should go away.
Thanks, Cindy. Clay and Wheeling.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. For a couple callers ago, I am also in favor of the Lingerie League coming back.
Yeah, that's good.
It's actually called the Legends Football League.
I think we're building towards a consensus, Clay. Yeah.
I mean,
excuse me, the Legends.
This is quite spectacularly unbelievable that this happened. It's awesome.
Yeah.
My initial point.
I'd be willing to front some cash to get that thing restarted.
Myself is included in that as well, Dan.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I could round up a couple other guys to get involved in that as well. Really help these women out. Since you brought up this topic this morning, I have started identifying as a female. So now my opinion is valid on the subject. So because Megan Rapinoe believes that gender is a social construct. So, and I'm sure as soon as I hang up this phone, then I'm going to go back to being a man. But I'm okay with the paper right now. I think they were quoted at 13%. I think that's what their earnings are at. Well, the men are at 10%. So actually, they're paid more by like 3%. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Clay.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. You could win $12,000 towards the purchase of a new car or to cover your existing car payments just by doing acts of kindness. Learn more at 560theanswer.com/kindness.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and note here, in addition to taking me to task for my less than complimentary comments about soccer.
Yes.
John Cass tweeted to remind us that today is the 200th anniversary of Greek Independence Day. So, well,
that's just, well, opa. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Good.
Yeah. Well. And so happy Independence Day to our Greek friends.
I got a text message from someone saying Megan Rapinoe, she should be on a guest on Deadliest Catch, since that is one of the, you know, professions where most men die. That she should, you know, she's so tough, she should go on that show.
I still want to. I want to go on the I want to go on Deadliest Catch. I want to be a deckhand on the Northwestern for the Ophelia crab season.
Okay,
that's on my wish list. So my birthday's coming up.
You may
see if you can arrange that. all right, so let's talk a little bit of COVID here. A fun moment yesterday between Ted Cruz and some reporter about mask wearing. Cruz is stepping to the microphone to address the assembled press, and then this happened.
Yeah, when I'm talking to the TV camera, I'm not going to wear a mask, and all of us have been immunized, so you're welcome to step away if you like. The whole point of a vaccine, CDC guidance, is what we're following.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. But you're welcome to step away. If I'm making you feel uncomfortable, feel free to leave.
And make us feel better. Oh, God. Make us feel better.
I mean, these people that I was at a press conference with Pritzker the other day, and there was a photographer from the Chicago Sun-Times, I believe. She had on not one, not two, but three masks and a shield and a bottle, a big bottle of hand sanitizer in one pocket and then a spray bottle in the other. And if you walked by her, if you even looked at her, she's like, how are we going to undo this? And I wanted to say, like, this psychosis that's going on.
Well, I'll tell you, it's going to be more challenging than people think, even as we're moving quickly towards herd immunity. Our friend Marty Makary, who is a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, has another op-ed in the Wall Street Journal speaking to that issue, which we'll go over in just a minute. But herd immunity is near, despite Fauci's denial. That's the headline in Makary's op-ed. Meanwhile, over at Bloomberg, it's an alternate universe. We must start planning for a permanent pandemic. Column by Andreas Kluth saying that we're not going back to normal. Highly unlikely. Recent developments suggest we may never achieve herd immunity.
What is she talking about?
He.
Even
the U.S., which leads most other countries in vaccinations and already had large outbreaks, won't get there. The upshot analysis by Christopher Murray at the University of Washington. That's the upshot. We're not going to get there. The main reason we're not going to get there, because the ongoing emergence of new variants that behave almost like viruses. And he cites a clinical trial in South Africa and the variants that we've talked about a bit and what we don't know about how effective the vaccines are against the mutations yet, because the mutations are new and there hasn't been the time to study them and so on and so forth. But there is supposition that they'll be at least somewhat effective against the variants. We'll see. But it's just remarkable. Herd immunity is near, Johns Hopkins doctor. Permanent pandemic. The chattering class, as represented by this Bloomberg columnist who used to be at The Economist, too, the globalist types. And Makary makes a point about how this is being misreported purposefully, you know, to create a sense of urgency. Lying, noble lying. Again, here we go.
For what purpose? Just to
get more people vaccinated.
Oh, that's right.
He points out that data from the California Department of Public Health released earlier this month show that while only 8.7% of the state's population ever tested positive for COVID-19, at least 38.5% of the population has antibodies against the coronavirus.
Exactly.
So, I mean, you know, 5X those who tested positive.
And samples that were sent into Northwestern, they had this 1 in 4 people tested positive for COVID antibodies in the Chicago area.
The same report found that 45% of people in L.A. had COVID-19 antibodies.
How many? I'm sorry.
45%. Okay. Even though, you know, 9% statewide tested positive. And here's the top line. Undercounting or removing the many Americans with natural immunity from any tally of herd immunity is a scientific error of omission. When people wonder why President Biden talks about limiting 4th of July gatherings, it's because his most prominent medical advisor has dismissed the contribution of natural immunity, artificially extending the timeline. His most prominent medical advisor, that would be Tony Fauci. He goes on to say, Makary, many physicians believe vaccinated immunity will prove more durable than natural immunity. I agree, and I think everyone should get vaccinated. But after a year of millions of COVID-19 cases in the U.S., it's clear that reinfections are rare. Natural immunity is real and shouldn't be ignored. But it is being ignored by Fauci. And why is it being ignored? Well, what's the effect of it being ignored? To extend the deadline, extend the timeline. And not and it and yes, on the one hand, you can say, well, this is about creating an urgency to get vaccinated. Noble lies. If you believe in such things, I don't. If you believe such things are legitimate, I don't. But as Makary points out, the obvious, it also creates false justification for continued excessive restrictions on freedom. Why don't you go ask the restaurateur in Holland, Michigan, who had to pay $15,000 to get out of jail for operating her business.
And her restaurant's closed now.
So this is an important piece. And Makary wrote last month that he was, based on his back of the envelope math, you were looking at herd immunity in the country by the end of April. And he's writing today that in the journal that we're nearing that. We're on that timeline. Oh, one other thing. Sweden. Sweden sort of disappeared from the conversation after it was providing the counterexample of the response to COVID-19 when all these knee-jerk lockdowns were being instituted. Sweden went with a light touch.
Yeah. All they did was cancel large rock concerts and they made college students go home for a few months. But then they came back in August and they're still in school.
Yeah, and they did. They ultimately, when there was a spike in the fall, they moved towards some more restrictive measures. However,
groups of eight or less. That's what.
Nothing like the lockdowns in the Western world, generally speaking.
No masks.
Well, Reuters and a bunch of other European public health professionals now have to reckon with the fact that Sweden is doing much better and has done much better than most of its Western European neighbors, and minus the economic devastation and the associated deterioration of the public health generally from the trade-offs that are just in the last month starting to be talked about in the old media with respect to mental health issues, with respect to missed appointments and screenings and so forth. Preliminary data from EU stats agency Eurostat shows Sweden did better than 21 of the 30 countries with available statistics on the issue of higher excess mortality than the prior year. Sweden was better than 21 of 30 countries for which they have stats. Sweden did worse than its Nordic neighbors, Denmark and Finland and Norway. But there are some unique things about Sweden versus their Nordic neighbors. Number one, the percentage of older people in nursing homes. Number two, an admission by Sweden that they could have handled the nursing home thing better at the outset. And this was an admission by Anders Tengel, their state epidemiologist, months and months ago. Can we get any admission like that in New York? No.
Or anywhere else? No.
Illinois?
But also,
they
run their nursing homes different than we do here. They have hundreds of people almost at a nursing home, whereas we don't have that. And 72% of the people who died in Sweden, 72%, 80 years or older. So most of them were nursing home deaths, and there are roughly 13,000 people have died. About the same population as Illinois, and we've had 23,000.
And countries that went hard lockdown, Spain and Belgium, had excess mortality numbers that were 2.5 to 3x Sweden's. So you have statements like this now coming out of the public health community. They do raise a question about whether, in fact, Sweden's strategy was relatively successful. That they certainly raise the question. Yeah, don't they? Anders Tegnell, that epidemiologist I mentioned, I think people will probably think very carefully about these total shutdowns, how good they really were. They may have had an effect in the short term, but when you look at it throughout the pandemic, you become more and more doubtful. With each passing day, I would say, wouldn't you? And again, you heard it on this show, and I've mentioned this guy intermittently over the last year, Johan Gasecki, the former state epidemiologist for Sweden. This interview he gave in March of last year, at the outset of it all, as the lockdowns were just starting to occur. Come to me in a year. We'll see. Very skeptical of these lockdowns. How do you, once you get in, how do you ever get out? And look at these states that went full lockdown, struggling to get out with any sort of permanency.
We're still in it.
Oh, by the way, those states that had zero excess mortality, Norway, no excess mortality at all in 2020. Finland's was 1.0%. Denmark's was 1.5%. They were the lowest in Europe. You know something else about those Nordic countries, similar to Sweden?
They don't wear masks.
Kids are in school.
Oh, kids are in school, yeah. Even kids. In places where they're having their third lockdown, like my friends in the Netherlands, kids are still in school. They are not social distancing. They are not wearing masks, and they are playing sports. They shut down the restaurants and the bars, but they always kept the schools open.
Kids are in school. And here, $350 billion and vaccinations being made available, and all of the PPE and all of the
HEPA filters.
Exactly.
And now 6 feet to 3 feet. We still can't get our shiite together to get our kids back in high school. I'm in high school every day. I have been for the last 3.5 weeks. And nothing's moving. Nothing is going on. There's no progress being made. It's the same stuff that was in the hallway in the summer that is still sitting there.
Of course.
Because they don't care. They don't want to go back. These teachers are extortionists.
Randy Weingarten, she is the leading light of the teachers' unions in the country.
Oh, yeah. Tell people this one.
It's not good enough.
No, the CDC is lying. Dr. Fauci's lying. They're not telling the truth. We have to be 6 feet apart. This 3 feet apart, it can't be possible. It is possible.
The AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, We are not convinced that the evidence supports changing physical distancing requirements at this time, and so they'll continue. You know, now the CDC just gave them another reason to hold out. It's remarkable.
And they're scared about lunch because people might spread droplets from their mouth while they're eating.
Whatever. Well, I mean, it's the same people that were scared about, the toilet seats not being properly.
They wanted lids for the toilets.
Whatever.
Because you could get COVID up the butt.
It's just getting more. It gets more and more ridiculous as there is less and less evidence to support their contention. Well, actually, there was never any evidence to support their contention. Mm-hmm. But now all the evidence that's coming in runs contrary to the position they've taken. But it doesn't matter. Mm. Logic free. Evidence free. Emotion only. Power exercised.
New York's public schools are back. New York high schools. They went back on Monday.
And by the way, just comparing Sweden to, and then again, one of these hardcore lockdown countries, Czechoslovakia, celebrated by the European press corps, and thus the press corps here. Check out my tweet of the graphical representation of how the Czech Republic did versus Sweden, the lockdown versus the light touch, just as more evidence on this. Each passing day, what you heard on this show from the first day, the skepticism from relying on experts, not just my women's intuition, Johan Gasecki, people who knew, looking at the history of this, how we've dealt with viruses in the past, raising questions. Each passing day, we here were ahead of the learning curve and you with us. As the evidence comes in, the case just gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And this is not to trumpet our show solely, it's to say, have the courage the evidence demands to make sure you never go along with what was done again.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Why are school boards important? And don't tell me, well, obviously they're important. If it's so obvious, then why don't you participate? Not you, but, you know, the people you know in your social circles. You're listening to this show. You're more likely than not participating, going to vote on April 6th. But maybe that's something you should challenge those you know with. If it's so obviously important, why don't you participate?
Well, because, now people are.
Because this is what's happening, and I don't know what the percentage is. I don't know that anybody knows at this point. But it's a growing percentage in the government school systems. I would suggest, just intuition, that it's a majority of school districts. Mary Tomback is the board chair of the school board in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. This is how she started their meeting this week.
By taking a moment to acknowledge the recent atrocities committed in Georgia. Last week, six Asian women, along with two others, were targeted and murdered by a white man. Not only was racism and misogyny the motivation for these horrific acts of violence, but they have been rampant in the ensuing police investigation and the mass media reports of the tragedy. This nation has a horrible history of cruelty against the Asian community. And since former President Trump's hateful and inflammatory finger-pointing in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, verbal and physical assaults against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders have increased dramatically. So as we have talked about many times in our meetings and within our district, we all must take responsibility for how our behaviors have perpetuated a culture of racism, exclusion, patriarchy, and white supremacy. How we have marginalized those of Asian descent, labeled them as the enemy, or sought to make them invisible. I certainly know that I, personally, have much to learn, and I must do better. So in addition to the personal changes and growth that must occur, systems must change too. And public education has the power and responsibility to mold hearts and minds in ways that can either perpetuate a culture of racism and oppression, or can seek to end it. Here in St. Louis Park, we are doing some of the necessary work to end it. Our new strategic plan, the board's commitment to equity and anti-racism, our evolving hiring practices and curriculum changes, and our budget processes. All this work is underway, but there is a long way to go.
Sure, we need to keep Democrats out of the White House so Japanese Americans aren't interned, right? Right, Ms. Tomback.
Did Ms. Tomback know that two people that were killed, one was a white man and the other a white woman?
Yeah, she said two others.
Yeah,
others.
And those others.
The two others that are unhelpful to this story that I'm about to tell. That was a complete fact-free description of what has...
Sickening.
Almost complete fact-free description of what's happened, both with respect to the murders and the investigations into those murders in Atlanta. But you tell a fallacious story to support a fallacious philosophy, pedagogy, which is what she got to then at the end. This justifies our anti-racist, translation, racist curriculum. This is happening everywhere, including in your school district, at some level. It may not be as pronounced as that sort of statement from your local school board president, but it's happening.
Everyone made a statement. Middle school, high school, CPS made a statement about Asian hate. I got a letter from my hair salon about Asian hate.
Uh-huh.
It's like, remember when you got guidance from your storage locker during COVID when it first began? Everybody's so woke and so, you know, everyone has to say something about it.
And so the question becomes, what does anybody who recognizes that flim-flammery for what it is, what do they say about it? What do you say when somebody gives you that rap that you just heard from that school board president up in Minnesota. What do you say? What do you say if you're on the school board? Much like we've seen these hysterics at the Oak Park Village Council. What do you say when somebody gives you a line of poison and says, everybody lap it up? Do you lap it up? Do you just quietly say, I prefer not to ingest the poison? Or do you call the poison for what it is? Say, you're promoting racism. You're promoting distinguishing and separating people by non-behavioral identity traits, and I'm not going to play a part in that. And that's not the business of this school, by the way, or this village board and municipality. Who stands up? Who stands up to the ghastly, sinister, really, sinisterly ignorant Mary Tombax of the world? Well, time to profile another local race on this show. April 6th is Election Day, and that includes up there in Tony Nutrier, New Trier School Board. New Trier, which, as I mentioned a couple weeks ago, maybe a sore subject for some there on the leafy suburbs up north. New Trier is dropping like a stone in the public school rankings in the state.
Oh, no.
When it comes to STEM and general academic performance and so on and so forth.
Bubbles coming out of the champagne?
One of the candidates holding himself out for office there on the school board is somebody we've spoken with before. We actually talked to him a couple months back about hydroxychloroquine as a therapeutic for COVID. He is the president of the Illinois Sports Medicine and Orthopedic Centers. He's the medical director for the Foundation for Orthopedics and Regenerative Medicine, retired assistant professor at Rush Medical College in the Orthopedic Surgery Department. He is Dr. Chad Prodromos, and he's running for New Trier School Board. Chad, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me on.
What was the basis of you deciding to undertake this?
Well, I think that the schools should have been open. New Trier should have been open with precautions, safely, and we saw a motion in that direction. And then we saw it stymied, and it was stymied by legitimate fear by people in the community that by opening the school that it would be bad for public health. As you know, I do research in this space, and there has been abundant studies going back to the summer since, you know, before school was going to open again, showing that we can do this more safely. I have expertise in this area. I'm very busy. It's not like I needed something else to do. But I just think that if you have a, if there is a need and it's unmet and you can help fill it, that it's your obligation to help meet it. My goal is to serve as an unpaid consultant to the school board, so that I can explain the science to people there. There is a physician on the board who is stepping down. There are no other physicians running. And I think that it's just my obligation to get out there and explain to people how the schools can be open safely and help interpret the scientific data.
Well, where would you begin? I mean, what was the, if you had, you know, you're on your soapbox and you could explain to them what COVID really is and how it really, the transmission rate between student to teacher, which I believe there are no reported cases yet, what would you say to them?
Well, I would point that out. There's abundant data from multiple sources. One is from overseas, and there was elaborate contact tracing done in the UK and elsewhere that shows that community spread from schools is extremely low. That young people, as I think is known, have probably less or at worst no worse adverse health outcomes from COVID-19 than they do from the flu. So it's extremely safe. There was a recent study of every professional athlete, basketball, you know, NHL, NBA, NFL, Major League Soccer. I'm leaving one out, I think, that tested positive. There were 789 of them. None of them became seriously ill. They were looking for heart problems, which earlier people thought might be a problem. Five of the people, when they were doing blood tests looking for it, had positive heart enzymes, but nobody got seriously ill. The point is, and I'm a former member of the Medical Advisory Committee of the Sports Medicine Council of the Illinois High School Association, that sports are safe. And the younger you are, the safer. These are people in their 20s. These athletes are younger than that. So I would point out that sports is safe, that school with distancing, with masks, with absolutely protecting those at high risk is safe. The students are low risk, absent those with comorbidities. The teachers, most of them are low risk. Some of them are high risk. The households vary. So you absolutely have to make allowances to not transmit it to high-risk people. But having said that, it's basically safe to bring people back. And finally, forgive me, people cannot ignore the horrific cost that being out of school carries to children, for depression, for obesity, for suicide, for families losing businesses and the health consequences of that. So you have to recognize that, and we have to get the kids back safely.
What do you mean they can't ignore it? They have been ignoring it. They absolutely can ignore it. And, I mean, this is, you know, as I was so often told when I ran campaigns up Nutrier, it's the most educated district in the Western world. So I'm going to suppose that people are not being willfully blind, that they're intellectually curious, that they're reading a lot, keeping up with the information that is coming out with respect to schools in particular, since we're talking about the school board here, so that they know or should know all the things that you just said. So what happens?
Well, it's difficult.
So what happens when you get on the school board and they say, oh, that's all very interesting, Dr. Prodromos, but it's not persuasive to us?
Well, I'll tell you exactly. I have a website. Can I tell you what it is?
Yeah,
of course.
Ahead.
Yeah,
sure. It's Prodromos NT. My name, PRODROMOSNT.com. So www.prodromosnt.com. On that website, you know, I explain why I'm running. I explain that this is completely non-political, that I want everybody's views to be respected. But on there, I have a whole section on articles, and I post it. There's a drop down on safe school opening, on sports, on vaccines, on early treatments, on ventilation systems, etc. And I put these articles out there. These are from medical journals, but each of them has a paragraph explaining the article and saying both sides of it. This is not meant to be one-sided. You know, the issues for vaccination, there are pros and cons. So the difference is that this science is complicated. It's complicated for us. I have scientists. We read this. We go over the methodologies. We analyze the results. So the difference is, when you said we say this is not persuasive, well, I would say I think it's difficult, and I don't mean to be patronizing, but, you know, impossible in many cases for lay people to understand this stuff. And my goal is to explain it. I can be contacted on the website. I'm there to answer questions so that the science can be elucidated. Mm.
Well, here's the question. Let me phrase it another way. What happens if and when you realize something that I think is present, which is that they're not interested, some are not interested, many are not interested in a good faith discussion of the merits of both sides of any aspect of COVID-19. They have staked out positions, largely rooted in ideology, and they will cling to those positions until and unless it becomes politically unpalatable for them to do so, just like the politicians we see in governor's mansions, including the one located in Springfield in this state. What do you do then when you run into people you say, well, I don't want this to be political, and they say, oh, that's interesting, Dr. Prodromos. They won't say it explicitly, but they're essentially saying, yeah, well, it is political, and that's how we're going to do it.
Well, you know, I am not here to question anybody's motives. My point of view is to give everybody the benefit of the doubt that they're sincere and well-meaning. how much of that exists, I don't know. But I do know that what motivates most people, and I see it in my patients, I've never stopped seeing patients, I talk to a lot of people, what has happened is there was a tremendous amount of fear. And some of this fear is certainly warranted, but some of it is not. So my goal is to assume that everybody, my purpose is to assume that everybody is well-meaning, uh-huh, and to explain the science. I think, you know, perhaps some people are not. I think most people are. That's something that I really can't get into. But I think that by spreading, you know, forgive me, but truth and knowledge and assuming the best about people, I think things will improve.
Well, look, I respect the position, and I think it's a fine approach. I mean, I really do. But I'm just saying, you go to the Wilmette train station from 6 o'clock to 8:30 in the morning, and then you come back to me and tell me that most people are of good faith and, you know, trying to get to the truth in communities that comprise New Trier. I'm sorry, but I know too much to sort of abide that wishful thinking.
You know, as I said, I can't tell what's in people's heads in that regard. And you're a very smart man. So I think there are others that have a better pulse on that than I. But it's, you know, it's a full-time job just trying to elucidate this.
Yeah. I know.
And
it's
that what you're saying, you know, that I think that if people really understand, I think things will move much closer toward getting the kids back towards improving. And that's really all that I can do.
Okay. And are you looking like Monday through Friday school without hybrid, no e-learning anymore? Is that your goal for the fall if you're elected?
Yeah. Yes. Full in-person learning. Now, people have to be protected. And, you know, varying degrees of social distancing, that's a moving bar, as you know. Masking, but getting the kids in particular, having them in the classroom. You know, maybe there are some high-risk teachers that shouldn't be in there with them, but the kids have to be there, and that can be done safely.
Well, those teachers should retire. I mean, or go make solar panels. I'm sorry, but I'm sick of this. They knew what they're getting into. There's germs associated with children, and you can build up your immunity and get the vaccine as well.
Yeah, absolutely true. The Great Barrington Declaration, for example, I'll throw it out there for those who haven't read it.
Yeah, that's good to throw out there. With respect to some other issues, too, you're running with a slate of candidates, like Julie Cho from Evanston, right?
Right. It's not a formal slate.
Not a formal slate, but you're allied.
But Julie and I, yes. Julie and I are the two independents running, and she's a smart, well-intentioned lady. And very efficient as well.
Yeah, she's Asian American, and I know Julie, so I'm sure she'll be really excited when she gets all these white champagne socialists on the North Shore very concerned about her and her fellow Asian Americans, like you heard from that school board president in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. Well, what's the position with respect to the racialization of education? New Trier is one of the lead offenders when they had the I Hate White People Day a couple of years back that has now been stopped. So that's, a positive note. But what about the racialization of education, the anti-racist, quote-unquote, curriculum, and so on and so forth that we see all over the place, including at New Trier?
Well, so I've been a part of this community forever. I graduated New Trier in 71. My siblings graduated in the 1950s and 60s. My children graduated in 2012 and 15. So my feeling is this. I know this community well. I grew up in Wilmette. I live in Winnetka now. And I believe that most people in this community are fair-minded, are inclusive, are not racist, are good people. There are bad people every place, our community, every community. And I think that assuming the worst and trying to seek out racism where you don't see evidence that it exists is bad on many fronts. It's bad to tell children that they are inherently bad, that their children are inherently bad. This is bad for them. This is bad for families. And it dilutes the ability to really respond where you see real evidence of racism. So where it's seen, it must be addressed. There must be aggressive re-education done to get rid of it. But it is the purpose of the school to focus on academic excellence, to absolutely make sure that people are not bullied, that they are included. But the way to do that is to focus efficiently where you find it, not to seek it out where it doesn't exist.
He is Dr. Chad Prodromos. The website, Prodromos, PRODROMOSNT.com. He is a candidate for New Trier School Board and president of the Illinois Sports Medicine and Orthopedic Centers. And again, his sort of independent candidate, de facto running mate, Julie Cho from Evanston, is also another candidate I would encourage people to check out up New Trier Way. Dr. Chad Prodromos, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with your candidacy.
Thank you very much for having me on. You have a terrific show. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and with respect to President Biden's announcement yesterday that Reparation H would be a riding point on a key issue, see if you can figure out what was my favorite part.
But I've asked her, the VP today, because she's the most qualified person to do it, to lead our efforts with Mexico and the Northern Triangle and the countries that help us. We're going to need help in stemming the movement of so many folks, stemming the migration to our southern border.
What was my favorite part?
Stemming?
No. So Reparation H is going to be the point person to deal with the, don't call it a crisis, at the border.
Oh.
Most qualified. She's the most qualified person to do it.
Really?
Based on what?
Based on what?
What has she done? What executive function has she ever performed? Not to mention, what is her particular expertise on immigration policy or...
I don't know. This was her yesterday in Florida.
Do you plan to visit the border?
Not today. But I have before, and I'm sure I will again.
There you go.
Oh.
That laugh. It's
even more infectious than COVID. It really is.
I see.
Yeah. But I mean, again, to be fair to Reparation H, mm-hmm. when Obama appointed Biden to ride point on the border, I'm sure, I don't remember what he said, but I'm sure he said the same thing, just to give some sort of, you know, throwaway honorific on the vice president. Here, you handle it. You talk to the press. I don't want to talk about this anymore. Good stuff. Good stuff. Fun times. A funny, funny pair, Biden and Kamala. For more on this and a couple of other issues, pleased to be joined by David Harsanyi, senior writer for National Review, author of First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun, From the Revolution to Today. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
So Vice President Harris is on the job. Now it's going to get real.
Well, it's the sort of thing you do to make it seem like you're doing something, but you're really not. Obviously, when you look at polling, it's already problematic for them, the situation, and should be. And that is with the basically most of the media just covering for them by calling it, you know, a situation or something instead of freaking out about kids in cages, where they are right now in far larger numbers. So, you know, it's the usual.
Yeah, but yesterday they let cameras in for the first time, and they had time to clean up those. It was in Donna, Texas. They had time to clean up that place and shift some of the kids to other shelters to make it look really good. Did you see that?
What kids? There are no kids here.
Oh, yeah. No, they're playing soccer. They showed how they get tested for COVID. 776 are in this one shelter, and 102 of them have tested positive for COVID. And they kind of put that on the back burner. They put that, you know, the last part of their package that aired on television last night.
I know it's sort of lame to always say, can you imagine what this would look like if Donald Trump had done it? But I can't help myself. I mean, it would be just the biggest freak out ever.
Speaking of the same old, David, when are we going to get these weapons of war off our streets?
Yeah, this debate drives me crazy. Yesterday, I feel like I'm writing the same thing over and over again, because Democrats constantly go back to the same exact legislation, the same exact arguments that, you know, and they never answer the question, how would this have stopped the Boulder shooting? How did this stop the shooting in Georgia? How, you know, they never have to do it. And because obviously the legislation, the universal background check, the AR-15 ban, you know, it would not do anything to stop shootings, would not do anything to stop murders. But, you know, it's the same old, same old with them.
David, the former president of the United States, Barack Obama, informed the nation that it's easier in this country to vote than to buy a gun. Can you imagine?
That is, I've noticed that talking point everywhere now. Now, you know, it combines two of their pet issues. But the problem with that is that obviously no one sends me an AR-15 in through FedEx to my house. I have to show ID before I get a gun, and I can't do same day background checks and get my AR-15. It's insanity to say that. But he used to say that we could get a book easier. Kids can get a gun easier than a book or a computer. It's just, you know, it's just ridiculous.
Clearly, he's never owned a weapon because he's got, you know, he doesn't know about the 3-day background check. I mean, we still have background checks, and why are they acting like every time there's a mass shooting that we need background checks? We already have background checks. We already have rules and laws in place, but the bad guys don't follow the rules or the laws.
Yeah, and sometimes they do, right? Like, you know, this Boulder shooter went and got a gun. He had not been violent before, even though he's on the FBI's radar, which they constantly drop the ball using the laws that we already have. So the universal background check is, you know, legislation is just, it's not operable. It doesn't help with these situations at all. They just want to stop private owners from being able to sell a gun to another person. And on the AR-15, it's going to be unconstitutional. It's clear in the Heller decision that AR-15s are commonly used guns. They're semi-automatic rifles. And if you try to go forward with a bill on that, the Supreme Court might overturn it and then overturn state AR-15 bans as well, I think. So I doubt they move forward on that.
Well, something else on the substance of this, too, it's worth noting, is that Colorado has red flag laws. And you had this individual, according to, you know, people who have now spoken to the press that knew him from high school and stuff, hair trigger, violent temper. He had the assault incident in high school and so on and so forth. But nobody thought it was serious enough that they should go to court to get his Second Amendment rights removed. So it also, again, the idea that you have this panacea, it's a red flag law. It's the universal background check, really, to deal with private sale exemptions, like you're saying. They're not panaceas.
Right. Right, and thank you for mentioning that. Colorado has the entire menu of you know, policies that they want to pass nationally. There's a universal background check. There are red flag laws. The police already have the ability to take a gun away from someone or prohibit someone from having a gun who is violent or a threat to themselves or others, and they rarely use it. Now, obviously, it's complicated. Every situation is unique, but that also tells us that these laws nationally aren't going to make much difference either.
I mean, it seems to me, you know, I know Biden telegraphed, like, you know, executive action, and people, you know, got all excited about executive action, and then they backed off that. They don't really want to do anything. They just want to demagogue the issue, score the political points, move on to the next thing, isn't it? Isn't that right?
I think so. I mean, I just don't think that they have the constitutional right to do anything through executive action or most of the things that they want to do, pretend to want to do. You know, legislatively.
Let's move on to D.C. becoming a state. What's the likelihood that that's going to happen?
I think not at all likely that it would happen. But it's part of a bigger sort of message they want to send about how Republicans want to deny people their right to vote and don't want, you know, and don't care about democracy and so on. And the truth is that the more powerful D.C. becomes, the more reason we have not to make it a state. And there are many other things we might be able to do, maybe shrink what D.C. is and give, you know, put people, those people who are outside the new smaller borders into Maryland or Virginia where they belong. But what we don't do is give two Senate seats to the federal government, because everyone here, and I live in that area, are reliant on the federal government in some way. And the founders clearly did not see it that way. They made D.C. specifically not to be a state. So there is really no good argument for it.
I wish they would have precluded Illinois from becoming one. David Harsanyi, senior writer, National Review, author of First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun, From the Revolution to Today. David, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good Good morning, Dan and Amy. You familiar with Club Pro Guy?
Club Pro Guy?
You never heard of Club Pro Guy?
No, what is it?
All right, so you golfers out there, you don't even need to be a golfer to appreciate it, but Club Pro Guy is this social media star. It's like a spoof character, but his videos are hysterical, and he does really good satire. Talk about a dying art. Well, finally, the teachers' unions are the stuff of punchlines, long overdue. And they were implicitly the target of the latest mailbag session from Club Pro Guy. Somebody had written in about his instruction and why it was only virtual.
Hey, everybody, Club Pro Guy here, coming to you live from the Learning Center. It's mailbag time. Today's first question comes from Janice Schaefer right here in Kansas City. And Janice writes, CPG, in late December, my husband Jerry purchased a year-long game improvement package from you for our son Easton. It's now mid-March, and Easton still hasn't been able to schedule an in-person lesson with you yet. What gives? It's a great question, Janice, and the short answer is, like most teachers in this country, I still don't feel comfortable for my own safety teaching in person, so I'm just going to go ahead and refuse to do my job while still getting paid. Now, I have sent Easton a few random George Gankus YouTube links, so he is learning virtually, which I think we've all established by now is good enough.
Yeah, and I'm on the waiting list to get into a Club Pro Guy's new club, Three Jack National, which is very exclusive, as I understand. Yes,
now I'm following him on Twitter.
Yeah, he's the best.
Club
Pro Guy.
He does one about March Madness, too. I want to watch
hysterical.
That.
He is so good. Punchline. The teachers' union position is a punchline for YouTube stars. So should this article in the Wall Street Journal be a punchline. Home buyers are heading to Florida during COVID, but nearly as many as are moving out. Oh, really? You know, it's so interesting, right? You got the emphasis initially was undermine Sweden because they're not going along with the lockdown orthodoxy. Now it's, you know, all this everybody is flooding out of Manhattan and Chicago and elsewhere to go to Florida, Southwest Florida or Scottsdale. Yeah. Oh, no, we got to undermine that narrative. No, it's not really happening. Florida's not really a growth state. No, it's not really good down there. Interesting. I mean, take a look at home prices year over year and the spike. That says something. And take a look at them in those areas where people are fleeing, as previously described.
And houses aren't even on the market for a day in some places.
This is such shoddy journalism. The reliance on one moving company survey, Atlas Van Lines survey, and the COO there says, you know, yeah, kind of surprised me because all the news stories about how people are overrun. There's a flooding of Florida going on in terms of people. Well, a good response from the Florida Chamber of Commerce Foundation's chief economist to this article. Florida is growing at around a net of 800 to 900 people per day.
800 to 900 a day?
Yeah. Most people who move into or out of Florida do not use the moving company you source in your story. So let me correct the incorrect assertion in the article. What's actually true is that substantially more people are moving to Florida from other states than leaving Florida. This has been true for a long time. All you have to do is check data from the U.S. Census Bureau. Every year, Census releases state-to-state migration data. It will show you that since 2012, 278,000 plus more people have moved to Florida from New York than left Florida to move to New York. It's the number one state for in-migration in Florida, followed by New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. It's no coincidence that the high-tax states are the ones with the highest net migration to Florida. What is actually true is that Florida is a large net gainer of population in both interstate and international moves every year. Since 2015, Florida has created more than one of 11 new jobs in the United States, and it's projected to grow by 4 million residents by 2030. It's also why, I mean, just again here, it's so silly, this article. explain to me, if as many people are moving out as moving in, why Florida is scheduled to gain one, probably two congressional seats after the 2020 census. That's a joke. But this is but the point is to say,
well, they're not reporting, they're promoting their narrative.
Correct. We got to undermine Florida. DeSantis could be a presidential nominee in 2024. Let's see if we can knock him out in his reelection in 2022. Let's get on it. You got to pour water on the story that Florida is this economic engine. Florida did it right. And with each passing day that DeSantis's position is faring well relative to lockdowners, emphasis on downers, Cuomo, Pritzker, Whitmer, et cetera, Newsom, with each passing day, it makes it more and more difficult. So you better get to work on that DeSantis guy and what's happening in Florida so that the people properly misunderstand the lessons. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by John Tierney again. He's a contributing editor at City Journal, former reporter and columnist at the New York Times, author of The Power of Bad, How the Negativity Effect Rules Us and How We Can Rule It. John, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me, Dan.
Well, I mean, we'll get to your piece, which really focuses on deaths from COVID versus lockdown, the sort of excess deaths conversation that's happening now globally. But, I mean, just as a former New York Times reporter as well, this Wall Street Journal story relying on one moving company survey to try to cast the situation in Florida in terms of net in-migration as something it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, there's this whole tendency the media just brought into this narrative that lockdowns were the answer, and they had just resisted any evidence that, you know, showing that, in fact, the lockdowns, there's still no good evidence that the lockdowns saved any lives, and they've inflicted enormous economic damage and death, as I, you know, wrote in City Journal. And what you're saying about Florida, I mean, the great comparison there is with California, where, you know, Florida was supposed to have disaster when it reopened last year, and California was the model. It was the strictest state in the country, strictest lockdown. And they did last year have a relatively low rate of COVID mortality. But then they had this big winter outbreak. And the best measure of what the pandemic is doing and what lockdowns are doing is to look at how many more deaths there were than normal, you know, all deaths, you know, all together with what they call excess deaths. And Florida is below the national average in that, and they're way below California, which is what, you know, which is significantly above the national average. So their lockdowns have not prevented deaths, they've caused more deaths. And, you know, and it's really striking. I mean, what's really awful about the lockdowns is that they've had this disproportionate impact on younger people, on minorities, on low-income workers. And you see that in these statistics. You know, Florida, younger people in Florida have done much better than younger people in California as far as who has died. And you also see this in Sweden. They got knocked. You know, the narrative was that they were killing people by not locking down. But Sweden and its neighbors, you know, Finland and Norway, who for most of last year followed the same policies as Sweden. People, schools were open, businesses were open, people were not wearing masks. And all those countries have done much better, especially among young people, than the rest of Europe. You know, Sweden's excess mortality is lower than the United States. And in fact, while the United States had this big surge in excess deaths among younger people, in Sweden, the deaths are lower than normal. So it's really an indictment of these lockdown policies.
Well, explain the excess deaths for younger people. What were they dying from?
Well, when I say younger people, you know, it's through middle-aged people too. But, you know, there were so many things. You know, people were not getting medical treatment. You know, there were more fatal heart attacks because people weren't getting, you know, seeking treatment. You know, researchers predicted there would be tens of thousands of deaths of despair, as they call it. That's from alcoholism, from fatal drug overdoses, from suicide. And, you know, because you didn't, you know, suddenly the drug treatment programs were shut down, alcohol sales surged. You know, it was that people thought, well, at least one day we'll have fewer traffic deaths because nobody's driving. In fact, what happened, there was a lot less driving last year. We had the highest number of people killed on the highways in more than a decade. And it's because there was more drinking, more drugs, and more high-speed driving on closed roads. So, you know, I mean, just the impact, you know, economists have really documented that when you have a big surge in unemployment, it just exacts this real social toll, and you eventually see more deaths
from that because, you know, people have lost their jobs, they've lost their businesses, they start drinking more, they just, you know, they start engaging, and, you know, they give up. And you know, and so we saw that, and, you know, and there was one study said in this article that, the number of people killed, the number of excess deaths, the number of deaths above normal, was especially high in counties that more poor people, more minorities. And these deaths, you know, were not due to COVID. They were due to other causes.
And just talking about those excess deaths, which you peg at about 130,000 per CDC numbers, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford said lockdowns are the single worst public health mistake in the last 100 years, and the implication is that these excess deaths is a good indicator of just how bad a mistake it was, particularly against the comparison of how many lives lockdowns allegedly saved. There's no real calculation on that, and perhaps that's purposeful so that people from, frankly, Donald Trump to Joe Biden can say it was going to be 2.1 million dead according to some, you know, phony baloney modeling from Neil Ferguson across the pond. And look, it's so much less than that. That speaks to how effective our policies were. Now, it was now Trump is not using that in terms of the lockdowns, but he is saying it generally speaking, starting from the premise of that model, which I think is a dubious premise from which to start. And so now you see the same thing happening. But for the lockdowns, what was modeled would have happened. And that's why we don't have to quantify the costs and benefits of the lockdowns.
Well, they just ignored the, you know, that whole calculation. You know, there have been more than 24 studies where, you know, in various ways where they've looked at two comparable places, and, you know, one with a lockdown, one without. And what they keep finding over and over is that the pattern of infection, you know, tends to be about the same in both places. And when you look, for instance, at the 50 states and you rank them according to, you know, how stringent their lockdown was, with California at the top and Florida near the bottom, you know, you find there's one clear pattern that, you know, the stricter the lockdown, the higher the unemployment rate. But there's no pattern, you know, when you look at COVID mortality, you know, who had a higher rate or not. And but those numbers have just, you know, gotten ignored, you know, by the media. And they've really, and no one has really stopped and looked at what's the overall impact of this. You know, how many people are being killed by lockdowns, how many are being saved. And there's no evidence that the lockdown saved any lives, and we know that they're killing people. And as I say in the City Journal piece, you know, if a corporation behaved this way, if they continued to sell a drug or a medical treatment that had no proven benefit and known fatal side effects, you know, the executives of that corporation would be facing losses, they'd be facing bankruptcy, and they'd probably be facing criminal charges. You know, but the government officials who've done this, they still have never done cost-benefit analyses. They've never looked at the big picture. They just said, we locked down, and it must have worked, so we're going to keep locking down.
He is John Tierney, contributing editor to City Journal, former reporter and columnist at the New York Times, co-author of the book, The Power of Bad, How the Negativity Effect Rules Us and How We Can Rule It, which I highly recommend, as I do his column, Death and Lockdowns, which I'll tweet out. John, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and talking about reparations in Evanston specifically, but you know, Evanston won't be the last community to do something like they've done, which is pass an ordinance providing $25,000 housing grants to certain black residents of Evanston as reparations for past bad acts by the city of Evanston's elders of the day. We talked about this the other day, the sum and substance of the reparations program and sort of the cultural and racial conversation. I mentioned in that discussion there's a legal aspect of this, too, and C. Boyden Gray penned a missive to the Evanston City elders of today that was, of course, dutifully ignored, suggesting that there are serious constitutional problems with the reparations program they were at the time contemplating initiating, and of course, as we know, have now initiated it. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by C. Boyden Gray. He served as White House counsel under President George H.W. Bush and a U.S. ambassador to the European Union under President George W. Bush. His firm, C. Boyden Gray and Associates, has represented the energy industry, among other clients. C. Boyden Gray, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So fundamentally, Evanston has a 14th Amendment problem with their reparations plan, you suggest. Please explain.
Well, it's a racially classified program, which is impermissible under the Constitution, and actually there are statutes too that prohibit it. It's just not permissible. You can use a racial classification to provide benefits only if you have a really, really strong reason and link, nexus, connection to past discrimination. Some general study saying Evanston or the surrounding area was sometimes hostile to, by today's standards, to minorities is not enough. And the Supreme Court has been very firm about this. You have to have a compelling interest to do it, and it has to be carefully tailored, and there have to be no other reasonable alternatives. And here there are several reasonable alternatives that would benefit these minorities without the constitutional difficulties.
Yeah, so that's, you just laid out sort of the three-pronged test: compelling state interest, narrowly tailored, no other reasonable alternatives. Start with the reasonable alternatives and you suggest are easily accessible and thus undermining the constitutional position of the city of Evanston.
Well, the alternative, the most obvious one, is to put this on an income basis if the ultimate purpose, which I think is laudable, I mean, and should be sought if you could do it, you know, legally, is to, you know, reduce income inequality. And so if you limit a program to the poorest of the residents of Evanston, you're going to sweep in most of the people that the program now sweeps in, but it wouldn't have the constitutional difficulties. Some whites, some other minorities, or some other ethnic groups might also benefit, but that's not a bad thing if you're a very poor and disadvantaged white. There's no reason why you shouldn't benefit from this program as well.
Well, of course they would argue, well, you're not the descendant. The white person is not the descendant of slaves, and this is why that is not a reasonable alternative you present.
Yes, but being a descendant is not enough. You have to have a traceable link to a grandparent or a great-grandparent who was visibly and clearly discriminated against, and make it deserving, and making a descendant deserving of these funds. I think another far more direct way of addressing the disadvantage that is perceived here is to improve the education system. Evanston has apparently no school choice program, and the state has a tax credit for use by vouchers to for parents to let them and their children choose which school, the kind of benefit that I've always had, and probably, you know, you as well, I don't know. That would be perfectly permissible and 10 times, 100 times more effective, because education is the key to mobility in American society. It's not housing, it's education.
Right.
Why the state is restricting their voucher program is a mystery.
Right. And so, you know, it, one of the things that's lost in the conversation, you sort of mentioned at the outset, but I really want to underline it. The reference and the justification for what Evanston did is the history of housing discrimination in the city of Evanston, you know, sort of Jim Crow norms in the north. Okay, fair enough. I concede the injury, as you do. You say, you know, the history of housing discrimination is real and you concede the injury. But you're not providing a remedy to an injured party, and you're not punishing an offending party. And this seems to me sort of the fundamental fairness failure of these reparations proposals, even ones proposed by, you know, the founder of BET, Bob Johnson.
Right. You've described it pretty well.
Did you get a response? You sent this letter that we're discussing, laying out the legal case against their reparations program. You sent it to the mayor there, Stephen Haggerty, and members of the city council. Any response?
No. Mm-hmm. I've had several letters of support, basically, from members of the community who've read about this, but not directly from the city itself.
So what if they changed it to a housing program and benefits and included every race? Whites, Hispanics, African Americans, then it would not, they would be legal what they're doing, correct?
Yes.
So is that what you're asking them to do, or is what they should do?
If there's to be a dialogue, it hasn't really yet begun, but the simplest way to solve this is to use an income measure, poverty level, some percentage above or below. And that would be predominantly minority, I'm sure, vastly, but it would be legal. It would not contain these constitutional difficulties.
A friend of ours, a friend of the show here, Charles Love, who is a contributor to the City Journal over at the Manhattan Institute, wrote a piece recently where he basically said, look, let's just cut to the chase. The implications of the positions being taken by people like the members of the Evanston City Council is to repeal it is an affront to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So why don't you just be honest that your position is to repeal the 1964 Civil Rights Act, because you can't get to what you want to do without an acknowledgement and, frankly, a repeal of the 64 Civil Rights Act if you want to do this counting by race in all aspects of life.
Yes, I think it was Humphrey who said on the floor, if this bill, Senator Humphrey, if this bill turns into a quota bill imposing racial classifications, I'll eat the legislation. Well, that's what the civil rights groups have tried to turn it into over the years, the biggest effort being a now forgotten piece of legislation called the 1991 Civil Rights Act, which Bush vetoed, and the veto was sustained, and he was able to remove the offending sort of quota provisions out of that bill, and blessed by the Supreme Court, you know, a decade later in a so-called New Haven firefighters case. So there's a right way to do this, and there's a roadmap, and Evanston just ought to follow it.
I also like the standard that Hubert Humphrey laid out. I think that should be federal statute, that politicians have to literally eat the legislation they sponsor if the unintended consequences that are predicted actually come to pass. So with legislation like 700, 1,000 pages now, that's a lot of eating. And so, you know, maybe that would be something that would chasten some of those D.C. politicians. I don't know.
Well, it might be worth a try.
Yeah, right. C. Boynton Gray, he served as White House counsel under President George H.W. Bush, U.S. ambassador to the European Union under President George W. Bush. His firm, C. Boynton Gray and Associates, has represented the energy industry, among other clients. And we were talking about this letter he penned to the Evanston city elders about their reparations program, because this is not going to be the end of this conversation in Evanston. You can be sure of that. C. Boynton Gray, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Cause they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah!
Yeah, Campus Beat March Madness edition, and Oral Roberts should have to forfeit its Sweet 16 game against Arkansas, right? Right?
No.
What do you mean, no?
Everyone saw like, Oral Roberts, Abilene Christian, Loyola, Christian schools, God wins in basketball.
Whoa, Loyola, please. We're talking about actual Christian schools.
Okay. But yeah, Oral Roberts. Located in Tulsa there.
They're bigots, though.
Why are they bigots? They're not bigots.
Well, where's the NCAA to bar the selection of schools like Oral Roberts to participate in the NCAA? This is no Cinderella story. In this story, the evil witch wins, right? Havel Javeri is a op-ed writer for USA Today. The NCAA has always been more about paying lip service to ideals of equality and inclusion than action, but Oral Roberts' inclusion in the men's tournament proves how little they actually care about those words which are emblazoned upon on their basketball courts. Oh, yeah. And on the uniforms of Iowa Hawkeyes and so forth. BLM on Michigan's uniforms. Yeah. NCAA pressuring Christy Noem successfully, it would appear, to walk away from men in men's sports, women in women's sports. You see, because they have an honor code. They have a pledge. And that pledge, as a fundamentalist Christian college, is certain behaviors are expressly prohibited in Scripture and therefore should be avoided by members of the university community. They include theft, lying, dishonesty, gossip, slander, backbiting, profanity, vulgarity, sexual promiscuity, including adultery, any homosexual behavior and premarital sex, drunkenness, immodesty of dress, and occult practices. That is
Oh, my gosh.
According to this USA Today op-ed writer, those standards are wildly out of line with modern society and the basic values of human decency. Well, Roberts is indecent. You can't allow them to. And I know the basketball team may have nothing to do with it. He understands that, but he can't separate the team from the university. So before we just straight up ban Christianity and believing, practicing, let's at least take that next step and force Oral Roberts to forfeit. What do you say? Don't you think make the NCAA live up to its values? Wouldn't that be interesting?
I hope they keep winning.
We will pick up this conversation tomorrow and get your reaction.
Yes. Thanks so much for making us part of your morning. Thanks to Justin Kosick, our technical producer, and Quinn McCarthy, our executive producer. We're back here bright and early tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. And, Mike, just in case you were wondering, the press conference with Lori Lightfoot and CEO Janice Jackson has been canceled. Oh. I was ready to go. I have my list of questions. Darn it.
Yoga for you now.
Exactly.
Get a life already.
Got to get the kids back in school.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.